Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Thank you. I'm excited to ask you this question.
I'm excited to answer.
Okay. How many nights have you spent sleeping out under the stars in the campsite in your lifetime?
Four.
How old were you in those four times?
That's a rough guess, but how many, you mean without a tent or a camper or a trailer or a hotel room?
I'll give you the tent.
Okay.
No trailer.
Tent, let's say maybe 10.
Okay.
As a child between ages like, say, 6 and 10.
And so what are your memories of being out in nature as a kid, and how did that influence your feelings about it as an adult?
I liked some of it. A lot of it was inconvenient, having to hike someplace to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. And, you know, I'm pretty in love with my creature comforts.
Mm.
So I'm not a strong camper.
But do you have fond memories of just like hanging out outside as a kid, or were you always kind of a, eh?
No, I do have fond memories of like riding my bike around and going for walks and that part of the great outdoors. It was the sleeping part that I think was not...
the overnight not outdoors.
Yeah.
Well, this week we're going to be talking about the importance of our relationship to the natural world with our mental health and well-being. And it's not like we've never talked about it before, because how often do you hear someone say, just get out into nature. You need to get out into nature and everything will be fine. And that seems to be the prescription for a lot of mental health issues. If you're feeling depressed or anxious, you know, get out into nature. But we rarely talk about what that actual get out into nature process is. You know, most people think, I take a brisk, you know, hike, or I'll run peak to peak, or I'll mountain bike, you know, get it out of my system. Quite often when we talk about getting out into nature, it's almost in this like beating nature into submission in some way, and my body along with it. And that's going to help level my mental health. And there are benefits to that, you know, good exercise, hard work and exercise, excellent for the serotonin, dopamine, making us feel good. But equally as valuable, and maybe in some ways more valuable, is the experience of just being, with no activity, no goal or agenda, but just being outdoors in somewhere. You can be in your backyard. You know, it doesn't have to be out in the wilderness somewhere, but enough so that you sit and you're quiet enough and you start to pay attention to the bugs that are crawling nearby, or the feel of the grass underneath you, or, you know, the rock that you're sitting on, to really intentionally start to feel yourself as part of wherever you are. Because one of the things that we don't often talk about is that we're not separate from nature. We are nature. We as human beings are just part of the collective community, the ecological world of nature. And quite often we talk about getting out into nature as if nature exists somewhere far away from us. And so we have to make an effort. It's like going to the gym. I'm going to go to nature. But really, the reason it's such an important piece is that because we are connected to and integrated into the natural world, it's actually more unnatural to be indoors, right? To be hanging out in your cubicle or driving your car, or, you know, sitting in a restaurant. Like, that's the unnatural state. But when we're in that natural state, our natural state of just being out in the world, our psyche starts to feel calm. Like, the psyche, our spirit, our soul, feels at home. And that's where the restive piece of nature comes, is that it's actually bringing us home. And you don't have to do anything when you're home. You can actually just kind of relax when you're home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just lay out and take in the sights and take in the smells and the whole sensation. You know, we've talked before about earthing, you know, walking barefoot and allowing kind of the energy of the planet to absorb into you. And so, interestingly, the whole idea of connecting to nature and being in the natural world, I was contacted by a wellness person at Cal Poly a woman named Staley, and she's putting together an introductory wellness program for freshmen coming in to help them kind of get acclimated to the first time they've ever had to share space and be in, you know, in the dorms and how loud and chaotic it is and how can they find kind of those moments of peace. And we talked about the importance of reminding students, or maybe introducing students who spent their whole life indoors, to the health benefits of just being in Cal Poly, you know, so many places to just sit out. And so we decided to challenge the students to each of them find their own kind of piece of the natural world somewhere on campus, whether it's up on the ridge or out in the arboretum or someplace. And so I was thinking I'm going to challenge my listeners, challenge you to find some place, whether it's in your yard or in town or someplace that is your go-to sanctuary, where you just can feel like you're at home. And then I was contacted by an organization that I've never heard of. Are you familiar with the Central Coast State Parks Association?
Nope.
We are out of the loop, Hank.
Clearly.
Because they are an organization that provides interpreters, education for all of our local state parks here on the Central Coast. And so this nonprofit brings this essential education on how to connect to what you're experiencing in the state parks. I never knew that they were a separate nonprofit. And they put on the Wild and Scenic Film Festival. Are you familiar with that? I know. See, again, we're out of the loop. But they are putting on their first gala on September the 14th, the Butterfly Ball. And they've asked me to be the MC. So I figured I better get to know everything about Central Coast State Parks Association. And in my research, I had this amazing feeling of, oh, we need to talk about all the ways that we don't have to go searching for experiences in nature. We can just show up at any of our local state parks. And this organization has already created all of these educational venues and avenues to help introduce our children to the natural world, to educate us about what's happening, to help us feel connected. So this is a long way to get to today, which is introducing my guest, Kristen Howland, who is the executive director for Central Coast State Parks Association, CSPA. And she's going to talk about what she does as executive director. And we're going to talk about the Wild and Scenic Film Festival. We're going to talk about her 20 plus years experience working in natural resource management and as a park ranger and growing up being in outdoors. And she's a local San Luis Obispo County resident. And we're going to talk about the Butterfly Ball. And you might think when you hear Butterfly Ball that we will all be donning wings.
That'd be cool.
That would be kind of cool. I may have to find some. But it's actually the Butterfly Ball because of the conservation necessary around our local monarch butterflies. So that's where we're going today. And I look forward to opening up the phone lines and having people join us with their comments and experiences with wild and scenic experiences on the Central Coast. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, our number is 805-781-3875. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our show through Apple Podcasts. Ask your kids to help you find that app. Look for A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe, and then the shows will be there every week for you to listen to at your convenience. And if you have a moment or two, if you leave a review, it helps share the show with other people. You can also follow us on our Facebook page. We have photos and information about upcoming shows, along with our Instagram, which is Elizabeth_TRT. So as always, I look forward to seeing where the conversation takes us. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to start our show. Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with the Reluctance Therapist. And welcome my guest, Kristen Howland, Executive Director for the Central Coast State Parks Association.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for having me.
And is CSPA, is that correct? Is that your...
Yeah, we shorten it to CSPA.
Just so that you can...
Say it quickly.
Get it to. Yeah. All right, so here's what I know about Kristen so far. That you were born and raised on the Central Coast. That you are a wife and a mom to two girls, 6 and 4. But that also you have 20 years of experience in interpretation, natural resources, recreation, preservation, conservation, outdoor education, and leadership. That you recently were the director of education at the Catalina Island Conservancy.
Yes.
You were a park ranger for the Slo County Parks. And you spent 3 summers patrolling the Emigrant Wilderness in Stanislaus National Forest and were manager at Sequoia National Park. You are a certified interpretive guide, which I didn't even know there was such a thing of getting a certification in interpretive guides. I can't wait to hear more about that. You're also a trainer with the National Association of Interpretation. And you started all this by receiving your Bachelor of Science in National Resource Management and Interpretation and Planning from Humboldt State.
Right.
Did I miss anything?
Nope.
Okay. So we'll start here and then we'll go back and I want to talk about how you got interested in doing this work in all the 20 years. But let's start with where you are today and your role as executive director. What does CSPA do? Why is this nonprofit important?
Yeah. So Central Coast State Parks Association directly supports the state parks and all of their docent programs or interpretive programming. So like most government agencies, the top priority is not always education interpretation. It's typically infrastructure and staffing and things like that. So everyone needs an avenue for education and interpretation. So we provide that funding to help that education interpretation continue. So some of the programs we help support are providing transportation grants to schools to get them out to the parks to do these field trips. We provide a lot of money for props and different things to help educate better and help make the interpretive experience a little bit better for the listeners. We also provide an experience in our gift stores where our merchandise is very much interpretive in mission. So when they pick that up, they feel like they are taking home a part of their interpretive experience.
And so how long has this nonprofit existed?
Oh my goodness. I think it 1972.
Really?
Yeah.
And you might not know this, but why back in 1972, why was decided there was a need to provide funding to support the state parks?
I'm sure
we weren't. I mean, our state was in pretty good shape in 72.
Right. Well, I think, again, it's just kind of one of those things where it probably wasn't as important back in the day. And, you know, we needed more money for projects and, you know, just to be able to continue that. And there was probably so cooperating agencies are throughout the state to support different state parks and different venues within state parks. We're different in that we support 2 districts and fairly large districts. So whereas maybe another cooperating agency will only support a fort or, you know, a historical something.
So it might be an organization specific for just one state
landmark or, okay. Yeah, and raises funding to help upkeep that.
So how many state parks and do you support?
We I don't even know the specific number, okay. Which is kind of funny, but from Ragged Point all the way down to Osoflaco Lake. So we have a very large range. And within that range, again, we only support the interpretive and educational experiences. So these are the guided hikes. These are the interpretive panels that, you know, people can guide themselves on a hike and learn something while they're out there. It's the field trips, et cetera. So in 72, it was probably, you know, just one of those things where they started out trying to just resurrect something that maybe was broken down, but these cooperating agencies with the states started to increase in number.
And so how has the support been for CSPA in the Central Coast?
It's been really wonderful. It has its ups and downs, obviously. It's something that's hard to swallow when most people don't know who the Central Coast State Parks Association is.
I feel bad. Yeah.
But I didn't, to be honest, I didn't know either. To come on board, my mission in the years that I'll be as executive director is to get the word out about the Central Coast State Parks Association. Interpretation is near and dear to my heart. our next generation are lost without interpretation and finding our natural resources meaningful and relevant.
And let's talk briefly just about the Wild and Scenic Film Festival, because I'm assuming that this is your big fundraiser.
Yes.
Along with your gift stores at the different sites. So it's the week of the 14th through the 22nd of September. Mm-hmm. And is it a film festival every night, or, you know, how do people?
Yeah, so the Wild and Scenic Film Festival was started by the South Yuba Citizens League, and they basically were trying to raise funds to help save the river. So this was their big fundraiser, and now they've expanded to the point where they take it on tour, and it's gone throughout the U.S. and even some spots international. So we basically pay a small fee to be able to show their films at our venues and advertise it, get a nice, wonderful assistance in marketing this. So it's a good thing to have instead of trying to pull us out from scratch. But we have the Butterfly Ball, which is September 14th. And then we have the following week starts our actual film festival starting on the 19th, Thursday the 19th in Arroyo Grande at the Clark Center. And then Friday night the 20th at Los Osos Community Center. And Saturday night at the Fremont Theater. And then we have our Wild Child children's films at the museum on Sunday the 22nd.
And so if people want to find out more about these films, how do they get information?
They can go onto our website at centralcoastparks.org. They can also go to My805Ticks.
My805Ticks. And then just type in Wild and Scenic Film Festival.
So on our website, you'll see events, and you can click on that pull down, and it'll show you the Wild and Scenic, and you can click on that. As far as My805Ticks, if you put in the search line, either Central Coast State Parks Association or festivals will come up there right at the top.
And then let's talk a little bit about the Butterfly Ball, because I'll be emceeing that event. Why the Butterfly Ball is the theme, and why do a gala? Because there's a lot of galas.
There is a lot of galas. And there's three other galas the same night. Okay. So, you know, it's kind of one of those things. You can't pick a good night in San Luis to hold an event because the number of nonprofits here, everybody
there's
has an event.
There's always something going on.
So, you know, part of this is a little bit of a selfish fantasy, because I did have the pleasure as the director of education for the Catalina Island Conservancy of attending their conservancy ball. And it was just really a lot of fun. They had amazing bands. They had music. They had a lot of energy and emphasis behind conservation. And it was just a really neat experience to raise awareness to all walks of life. So I started thinking about what would our cause be? And obviously, the decline in the population of the Western Monarch is pretty weighing heavily on our minds right now, at least with us at the Central Coast State Parks Association.
Because I wonder if people realize that there's been a decline, because, you know, down on Highway 1, there are certainly not a decline in cars stopping to look at right. the butterflies. So what has happened over the last years?
So we've gone from hundreds of thousands of butterflies down to, I think we had about 2,000 in the grove this year, and I'm talking about the Pismo Beach Monarch Grove right off of Highway 1. Mm-hmm. So the clusters are extremely diminished, but for those visiting it who have never seen it at the hundreds of thousands, it's still an incredible experience. But for those of us who are used to the large numbers, for the scientists, it's scary to think that we could possibly be on the brink of extinction of the Western Monarch.
And so the Butterfly Ball is to raise awareness about the monarch.
Correct, yes.
And specifically the monarch, because you said that there are different types of butterflies, and we have this special breed here on the Central Coast.
Yeah, so the Western Monarch, there are Eastern Monarchs and the Western Monarchs. The Eastern Monarchs overwinter down in Mexico, and the Rockies kind of divides the Western and the Eastern Monarchs. So the Western Monarchs come all the way up from Canada, British Columbia, down to our area to overwinter. Many of the reasons why we chose to be here, because the weather is wonderful.
the monarchs knew as well.
Yes, exactly. So they stop off here, and then they head back up. So kind of why is the decline is kind of the next question. So this whole butterfly ball is about raising awareness about what's happening. So what can we do as individuals? How can we help this whole situation? Well, there are wonderful groups out there like the Xerces Society, which is a nonprofit group and a scientific group that supports invertebrates. So they have a great site on their website talking talking about the monarchs and the plight of the monarch.
And what was the name of that group?
Xerces Society.
Oh, you have to spell that, can you?
X-E-R-C-E-S.
Okay, thank you.
So the Xerces Society helps raise awareness for it, but they've also started to do some research and what the numbers are, how they're moving around, what's exactly happening. They don't know specifically, but we suspect that climate change obviously is having a effect on it. Also, the milkweed numbers, the number of milkweed, whether we're planting it or not, where we're planting it, how much tropical milkweed, which is non-native, is being planted versus our native milkweeds, and then pesticide use.
And so there'll be a couple short films at the gala, right?
Yes.
And music.
Yes.
And good food.
And good food. Dancing. It's going to be wonderful.
And you don't have to wear butterfly wings.
You don't have to wear butterfly wings. I call it Central Coast elegant. So whatever that means to you.
And then, again, if people want information, they can go to the website. Or is there a number people can call for information?
Yeah, they can also call 805-548-0390.
Okay. So that's the business of the Central Coast State Parks Association. But I want to talk about you, Kristen Howland, and your journey to being a steward of the natural world and why you're passionate about this and how you found your way to become a certified interpretive guide. Why is interpretation, because that almost seems counterintuitive to what I said at the beginning of the show, which was we are nature. We don't need to do anything more than go out there and be a part of it. Why is the interpretation so important?
Great question. We have lost some connection with nature. And I think that's the bottom line. And we have to figure out ways to reconnect us. Stephen Gould had a wonderful quote, "We won't save what we don't love."
So talk about that. You know, the efforts to introduce and keep people aware that they are part of the natural world.
Part of nature, yeah. Mm. You know, I think the key point for me in interpretation is relevancy. So how do we make nature relevant to individuals when people have become so disconnected, when they're not out there every day, when they're at their cubicles, at their computers, when kids spend all day in the classroom and then after school they're playing on their iPads? How do we get them to feel that this is relevant and important to them when they live in a neighborhood where there's no trees, there's only pavement? So those are all things that you I guess it's hard. It's hard to swallow sometimes to think that that's truly how life is. We're spoiled here on the Central Coast in many ways. Mm-hmm.
I think most people would say, well, that's not an issue here. We have sun almost all year long. Everyone's outdoors, mountain biking, walking, being in the beach. You know, we don't need to reintroduce ourselves to the natural world. But
yeah,
clearly
we do. And I've always said, we wrote so many grants for underprivileged youth, and I know that there are underprivileged and at-risk youth in more ways than one. But I also said, underprivileged youth could also be that very wealthy child whose parents unfortunately plug them into an iPad all the time. What's their experience with nature, and how is that relevant to them? So how do we make it relevant to them? How do we create these experiences? And it's all about this awe-inspiring moments in nature. The first time they stick their sand or toes in sand or, feel the ocean, it's pretty amazing to be with kids who haven't had that. I'd always wanted to work with at-risk youth from inner cities because I wanted to take them backpacking and let them experience that. I never quite got that chance, but I hope to.
Well, and what, just as an example, what is an interpretive experience that is an aha for kids that you've seen?
So let's talk about interpretation. Interpretation is basically interpreting nature to the layman. So how do we break down nature so it's relevant, it's something that they can easily understand, it's meaningful. So it's just breaking down big words, nature words, and making it appealing to somebody to understand. So when I think about kids in nature and how does this become something that's meaningful and that's interpretive? So it's not just the experience, it's them learning something from it as well. So, I'm trying to think of the billions of
when
different
your favorite
experiences.
Program, I know. Yeah. I should have given you a chance to think about it.
The thing, of course, that stands out the most, because I think that's the most recent experience I've had as an executive director. I don't get as much experience doing interpretive programs. But on the island, we had a group that would come over So they're bringing inner city youth from Long Beach over to the island. These kids had literally had never left their neighborhoods. Some of them had never seen the beach, let alone get on a boat and blow their minds by putting them on an island. But then add the experience of seeing a Catalina Island fox and learning that that's an endemic species, learning what endemic means and why that's important, breaking those down, from endemic to it lives here, it grew up here. You grew up in Long Beach. You grew up in this neighborhood. You're endemic to that particular neighborhood. You know, trying to create some understanding of what that means.
And a connection that we're all interconnected in some way.
Correct. Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And my guest is Kristen Howland. She is the executive director for CSPA, which is Central Coast State Parks Association. And we're talking about their work here supporting the educational and interpretive projects at our local state parks. And that covers from Ragged Point, you said, down to Oso Flaco. And the county park system is different. So when you talk about Lopez or Laguna, like that's different. Mm-hmm. But you're talking more about Morro Bay State Park.
Correct. Yeah.
Pismo State Park. Mm-hmm. Down to Oso Flaco. Mm-hmm. And each of these state parks has docents. How many docents or interpretive guides are there in just our Central Coast system?
Yeah, so it's the Slow Coast District, which basically is Montana de Aro up through San Simeon. Mm-hmm. That has over 300 docents. These are dedicated docents that spend their time creating programs and providing incredible programs, staffing the Natural History Museum in Morro Bay, and staffing the Spooner Ranch House and doing living history programs, doing walks, patrolling. They're amazing, this group of people. In the Oceano Dunes District, it's about 200 or more, and they staff the mercantile trailer out in the Monarch Grove in Pismo. They do roving. They talk to people every day about the monarch butterflies, at least during the monarch season, which is October through March. They provide staff the Oceano Dunes Visitor Center. They do hikes along the lagoon there. I mean, just amazing programs. I cannot say enough about it.
And are the docents all volunteers?
They are.
And how do they find you? You know, these people who are biologists before in another lifetime, or people that are just curious and they come to you and say, I have a passion for otters and I want to do an otter talk, or?
Yeah, that's kind of the way it goes.
Okay.
So the state parks has a volunteer in parks program. So people who are interested in volunteering go to a state park. Like the museum would be a great place, or the Oceano Dunes Visitor Center, if someone was interested. They basically say, I'm interested in becoming a volunteer. They go through a training, pretty intensive training, to learn everything about that particular district or resource. And then they can start doing their programs. And it's these are folks that a lot of them are retired teachers. They're experts in their fields, and it's amazing.
You know, some of the greatest times I've had visiting different parks is listening to the rangers talk about, you know, either it's an astronomy lesson or something about the indigenous peoples. And the passion, I've never heard a docent speak that wasn't so passionate about their topic that I didn't end up being passionate about the topic as well.
Yeah.
That's such a gift.
It is. It is. You know, I think, you know, one of the necessary ingredients for interpretation is passion. And when you have that passion, it does seem to be contagious.
And so I guess my ideal of us being out in nature and just being and feeling our body relax and start to recognize that, oh, when I'm in the natural world, this is my natural state. And if I'm there and breathing and relaxing, I'm going to start to become immersed in this experience. But as you're saying, if I'm understanding, the interpretive part is important because we have become disconnected. We have this ideal of everyone feeling comfortable just laying out under the stars or, you know, walking through the forest, but that isn't our natural go-to as a people anymore, and hasn't been for quite a long time. So it's almost as if the interpretive piece is that bridge to almost help bring humans back to their natural world.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, my main goal is to make people really love nature and understand why it's important. You know, we're going to start losing things. unfortunately. We're losing a lot. And so how do we make people want to stand up and fight for, you know, our natural resources, our parks, our trails, our things that we here on the Central Coast treasure?
Absolutely. My guest is Kristen Howland. Our number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. We're going to take a moment to catch our breath. We'll be back to open up the phone lines and take your calls. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Kristen Howland, Executive Director of the Central Coast State Parks Association. All right, so Kristen, how did you find your way into this work? How, I assume it's over 20 years ago that you set out to receive your Bachelor of Science in Natural Resource Management from Humboldt and interpretation. How did you find your way into that?
Oh my goodness. Boy, did I stumble and fumble a lot. So I graduated from San Luis High. I will be the first to admit that I was a terrible student. I had no direction. I was a challenging child. I think I was more blessed than what my parents actually think I was. But so I was going to Cuesta, kind of working on early childhood education. I worked in a preschool, decided I was never going to teach preschool, and I was never going to have kids. Never say never.
After that experience, like, and now I don't want to do that.
I was dating somebody who took me out on my first backpacking trip. Now, not to say that I hadn't been camping, because my parents were incredible. They took us camping all throughout our childhood. We spent all of our summers at San Antonio Lake. So I was very used to being outdoors and camping under the stars. But backpacking just takes it to a whole nother level when you strap on everything you need and you hike out where there's no cars and it's quiet. It's something else. So I can thank that boyfriend for that experience because it changed me forever. So I knew that I wasn't going to do much here fumbling at Cuesta. So I went up to Columbia Junior College in Sonora and I started taking natural resources classes. And I never went back to anything other than that. And I went from being a funky student to getting A's and B's. And that
was. You found the thing that called you.
I found something I was passionate about. And I was truly passionate about it. I loved IDing trees. I loved IDing mammals. I mean, it was just glorious. And oh my gosh, they made school fun. You went on field trips. You experienced things, you know, hands-on, which was not something I'd ever had. It was always sitting in a classroom with a book. So hear that? It was that experience that made the difference.
It hooked you.
It's that hands-on interpretive moment. I had some great teachers. So that one of the same teachers that kind of got me really passionate about trees and mammals offered or said I should really be a volunteer patrol ranger in the immigrant wilderness. So I started that experience, and it was truly amazing to strap on a backpack and be out in the wilderness for 10 days at a time and basically live out there all summer.
And when you're patrolling, are you just helping people along the way, or are you looking for?
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. So at the beginning of the season, you start off just checking trails and clearing trails. So we had a giant whipsaw that we carried on our backpacks on top of our regular backpacks. It was another 35 pounds you'd strap on, and then took two people to cut through giant trees that to move them off of the trail. So in the wilderness, you're not allowed to have any motorized equipment, so no chainsaws. So it was all man-powered. It was amazing.
Yeah. Amazing that when you're young, these things feel amazing.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if I could do that now. And so on top of clearing trails, then we'd also check campsites. We did one of my favorite things, which was called naturalizing. So you would take a campsite. There was a certain clientele that would build these huge fire pits out of rock, and the rock would be all scarred and there'd be no plants in the area. And so we'd start removing some of these sites, especially if they were too close to the river. And so you'd take rocks and you'd bury the burn side, and then you'd take the ashes and spread them out, and then you'd replant plants in the area. And by the time you got done, it looked like there was never a campsite. I love that. Mm-hmm. It was so exciting.
Restored.
Yeah. And then it was also just checking to make sure that people were following the rules and, you know, make sure there's nobody hurt. But majority was maintenance.
So you did that the 3 years while you were finishing your degree, I would imagine.
Yeah.
It was your summer internship.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then what, so you went up to Humboldt to finish with the BS. Why the interpretive piece? How did you get introduced to that thing?
Yeah. So there, it's changed now. Now they have it more segregated. But before, it was kind of all lumped into one. It was natural resources planning and interpretation.
Okay.
So now they have it broken down more. Interpretation was not something I focused on. I didn't really ever want to have to talk in front of people. I'm a little bit of an introvert trying to be an extrovert. When I graduated from there, I really just wanted to be in wilderness management. Unfortunately, there's not many jobs in that. And what jobs there are, they're primarily seasonal.
And so this, how many years ago was that?
Oh, my goodness. That was 2000.
'Cause I guess I'm curious, are there less jobs now? Because you would hope that 20 years ago, maybe there's more opportunities, because you hear about now that it's very competitive and tough to get into that work.
Yeah.
Is it gotten easier, better?
I don't know, and I don't think so, just because it is seasonal. So Wilderness Patrol, you know, half the time the wilderness is snowed in, so it's really only seasonal work during the summer. And I think they're all law enforcement rangers for the most part now within the National Forest and the National Parks.
And it said that you, though, worked as a park ranger. So is that another certification you had to do after you got your degree?
No. I mean, there is that avenue. So after I graduated from Humboldt, I went down to Sequoia National Park. And I worked there seasonally and moved my way up into being the lead visitor use assistant, I think they called it.
Okay.
So I basically managed two campgrounds and managed the seasonal staff and just kept everything running and added inventory. I'm always look back on these things and realize how blessed I was to be able to start off some of these things and get the experience I did.
And you were living
in Sequoia National Park. Yeah. It was fantastic. And I probably could have continued on that route. The first two seasons, digging my way out of the snow was okay. And then I was like, yeah, I'm a Central Coast girl. I'm going to go back. So when I came back, I started applying for jobs. I applied for state parks. And then I also applied with county parks. And I really, at that point, there was the shooting in Morro Bay in the campground. And I had to make my choice on whether I wanted to be a law enforcement ranger. I'm not comfortable with guns. So I wasn't comfortable with that. And county parks, they are not commissioned law enforcement. So I tried my luck at that. Started off seasonal, got through one season, and they hired me on. So I spent 12 of my 13 years at Lopez Lake.
Wow.
Yeah.
And at some point, I imagine you met your husband, because you have two daughters. So how did that happen?
My husband Charlie and I actually went to high school together.
Really?
Yeah. He's a little bit younger than I am. But it was on one of my trips back home from Sequoia National Park. And my friends were trying to hook us up. And I was like, well, actually, I think I know him. We both have a love of reggae music and organic food and gardening. And they thought we'd probably be a pretty good connect. So unfortunately, his best friend passed away. And we've been together ever since Ben passed away.
Wow.
Yeah, it was
so that
pretty
brought
amazing.
You together.
That brought us together. I say thank you, Ben, for that. And then we never thought we were going to have kids. And 9 years later, we have Abby and then our second daughter, Zaya.
And is Charlie also an outdoors person? Is he a...
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he is. His father was a teacher, science teacher. His mom was also a teacher, is also a teacher. But science was always kind of forefront in his growing up. So really into reptiles and snakes and hunting for those, which not my favorite pastime, but not that I don't like them. Everything plays a role in the environment. But he is a big avid surfer, and he's now a commercial fisherman. So he's out in the water today.
And then after the park ranger, then you went out to Catalina Island.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
My identity was as a park ranger. So it was really a tough decision to move on from that. Mm-hmm. But I kind of saw the writing on the wall as far as not a lot of growth for me. So I started kind of looking around for other jobs, and it was recommended to me that if I wanted growth, that I needed to move out from the county and do something different. So I took that advice, and as hard as it was, but started looking around. So the first time I applied with the Catalina Island Conservancy, we went down and visited the island and kind of went, I don't know if this is for me. And we left, and I got a follow-up call that said that they'd filled the position with somebody else. I said, that's okay, because I'm not ready yet. Yeah, I'm not ready yet. They'll call me back in a year and offer it to me. Manifestation. Holy mm-hmm. moly. A year later, I got the call. Hey, are you interested in coming down? So we said, okay, let's do this. So we were down there for 3.5, almost 4 years. Our anniversary of moving back to the Central Coast will be almost a year in September. So
how was life on Catalina with a young family and work and...
Wow. Well, I can definitely say don't move to an island 7 months pregnant and start a new job.
Yeah.
that was stressful.
You're taking all the big stressors of life all at once.
Yeah.
Moving,
yeah.
Having a child, new job.
Yeah. Did them all at once.
Good thing you stayed married. That was the glue.
Yeah.
So what's life like full time on Catalina Island then?
It was amazing.
Really?
It was a wonderful experience. Incredible. There's a very tight-knit community down there. People who've lived there for generations and are very strongly committed to the island. So the Conservancy is incredible. They do wonderful work there on the island. They're really trying to raise awareness about the endemic species on the island. My work there as the Director of Education was primarily creating programs, finding grant funding, making sure that, you know, the island residents themselves were educated about their island home and that they had the desire to preserve and protect the island home as well. It was an incredible experience. I can say that my favorite thing was probably walking down in the evenings and going for a swim in the very clear Catalina water. Yeah.
And so what was the transition now here to today, a year ago, heading up the CSPA as executive director? How did you, was it a desire to get back to Central Coast or was it the work?
Yeah. So I'm so thankful for my experience in government. As a park ranger, and then also for this nonprofit side down on Catalina Island, because it really did give me the avenue to come back home. So I had been applying for jobs to come back home. You know, we have this 6-year-old Abby who is just going into kindergarten. The island school is not my favorite. It has some work to do. So we knew that we didn't want to raise our kids there. We wanted them to have more opportunities. And so we just kind of started plugging along, and I was manifesting the best I could. I said I knew I wanted to be back in Avila Valley with my family. My dad was having health issues, and I just wanted to be closer to family. So I found this job. LinkedIn, you know, pops up, which is a beautiful thing.
Usually we ignore LinkedIn.
Yeah. But no, it was a great thing. So I applied for the position, and I'm so grateful that they hired me, and I get to accept the challenge of it.
Yeah. And so what is the challenge being executive director for this, for CSPA, Central Coast State Parks? What is your challenge?
Oh, my goodness. What isn't?
Okay.
Sadly, I think every nonprofit can attest to this one. But, you know, we're understaffed. We have myself as the only full-time person. I have a very part-time retail person and a part-time who works way more and way harder than she should, who is our membership and events coordinator. So,
hello, Alyssa.
Yeah. Hi, Alyssa. So, wonderful staff. But, you know, we're challenged. We have 4 retail stores that we manage. And so trying to keep inventory and stocked and, you know, make sure everything's running smoothly. But then we also have the membership side and the events. Oh, and don't forget about our firewood. So if you're at a campground on the Central Coast camping and you buy firewood from the host, you're directly supporting our organization. So thank you. So we also manage that too.
And then you have membership.
Yes.
CSPA membership. So people can just join and support in that way.
Yes. And there's benefits to that too, which is wonderful. We like to be able to offer discounts at our stores and there's member events that we put on for folks too to help give back a little bit. But so membership and maintaining that membership database.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Kristen Howland. She's the Executive Director for Central Coast State Park Association, State Parks Association, CSPA. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875 if you'd like to join us. And let's talk about the interpretation part, because I, again, before today, I had no idea that there was a whole certification and interpretive guide work, that it's a specific skill set to helping introduce people to what they're going to see when they're out in the natural world. Because, again, I'm kind of juxtaposition. I can't say the word now. I'm just a little pass on that road, that word. But I'm trying to pull these two things together, because one part is like, why would we need a guide or an interpreter or someone to lead us on a hike? We should be able to get outdoors, and just being there in the world should make us feel calm and at home. But at the same time, after talking to you, I really understand that there is a need for the education to awaken maybe that dormant part of us that is of the natural world, that we are creatures of the ecology, but we've become so separated as humans into our homes and our workplaces and our cement world, that the interpretive work has become crucial in helping awaken that thing that we all naturally have. So I'll tell you a quick story, and then tell me where interpretation has gone. 30-something years ago, my husband, then boyfriend, Chris, took me on my very first backpacking trip. And I'd never even slept outdoors until that time in my life. But we did a 7-day trip with 5 of his friends into Kings Canyon. And after we finished the backpacking trip, which I succeeded in, made it all the way through, the night before we left, we were in the campground there. And we saw this sign that said auto tour. A-U-T-O, as in car tour, auto tour. And so we drove on it, and it was a drive-through nature tour with signs that just said the river and pointed to the river, and then tree and pointed to the tree, and then different species of things that were there, but not even a long explanation, just these signs. And we thought it was hysterical that auto tour was there, and that people would actually come and never get out of their car and then go home and say it was in nature. Is that interpretation as you know it, or have things changed in 30-something years?
Oh, my, have things changed. Okay. you know, we still have interpretive panels. Those are something that's still a reality. But those interpretive panels go much more in depth.
Okay.
So there may be something that says, you know, this is a tree. Probably not. There'll be more of explanation. It might have like the species of the tree, why the tree is important to the environment, how we can help the tree. So there's a little bit more messaging there that makes it more relevant, and also how we as individuals can continue to help foster the environment.
And so when someone is doing interpretive work in a state park, are they focusing on the biology of that park? Are they focusing on conservation? Because, you know, I wonder if people get nervous going to an interpretive event because they don't want to feel guilty if all they're hearing about is how we're losing all of these species. Yeah. And so that would make me sad. Like, what is the uplifting part of the interpretation? Yeah. How do we create excitement and not just sadness?
No, it's so true. And I think that's a hard balance that we have to play, especially it feels even more kind of doom and gloom right now. But it's not that case. And I think the most important part of interpretation is just someone having that experience. So, I give you my latest experience, which it's been a while since I've been able to go out camping and do different things, job switching, moving, and all of that. But we just recently went up to the mountains and to Mono Hot Springs. And I was sitting outside. My husband had taken the two girls down to the river to fish. And I had a moment to just sit there and listen to the wind blow through the trees. And for me, it's easy to understand. I have a background in natural resources, but I was able to understand why those trees are there. I was understanding that we're in a riparian zone. I was able to look around and see the flow of water and why the water flew through that area. So it's just a moment of just looking around, thinking about what's around you, why it's there, how things have changed, you know, and then thinking to yourself, like, what is my call to action that I can continue to do? What can I pledge to do? And that's just my part in changing, you know, either my lifestyle that makes a difference worldly or bigger.
Well, and as you're telling the story, all of a sudden I had this visual of life prior to public education or formal education or going, you know, living in cities, that everything about education was awakening children to their world, why the water flows the way it does, so that you would understand when the fish would be coming through, so you'd know, understand how to get your food for the evening and where to build a structure so you're watching the wind and where it blows or how the sun moves across the valley. I'm sure other people have had this thought before, but that's maybe what we lost in our civilized world, is that ability to read the natural world the way we learn to read traffic in a busy city.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think the exciting thing about interpretation, you can see it in kids' faces. I was that, I say horrible mom as a joke, but every time I go on a hike with my daughter, we walk through and I quiz her on which plants. She can recite to me which plants they are, why they smell like they do, what their purpose is. And I feel like that gives her a sense of knowledge and independence and something that makes her proud, but also respects the nature itself for and why it's there. So I think when you give kids these tools, you're really empowering them. And I think that's the other kind of uplifting part of interpretation, is just empowering people to have the understanding of nature as a whole.
And to feel like that we all are docents or guides in some way.
Absolutely.
And so as a mother of two, what are some things that you have kind of pledged to yourself? How do you introduce the natural world to them, and how do you balance the anxiety or sadness of climate change and ecological changes, and still bring that positive hope for the future to your kids? Because I'm sure you and Charlie talk about that.
Oh yeah, definitely. And, you know, my girls are definitely observant and they're perceptive. Abby, my older one, is really entertaining, because she will be the first one to say, "Mom, when I grow up, I want to stand up in front of crowds and I want to speak to them about how they can help the environment."
We love that.
I said, "All right, wonderful. How can I help you do this?" But I think what my goals with my children is to have them have a greater knowledge and a greater understanding of their role, just a holistic view on the environment, but also empowering them that even the smallest things that they do make a change and make a difference, and that even having a conversation like we're having today can change somebody's perception and maybe change a lifestyle habit that's unhealthy for the environment. I'm not a doom and gloom person. I am an optimistic person, and so I focus on those little things that make things better.
And so in our last few minutes, let's talk about what you're doing to make things better, which is part of CSPA's fundraising, the Wild and Scenic Film Festival, September 14th through 22nd.
Yes.
There'll be films where?
The films are going to be at the Rock, at Sobre Rock, for the gala event, the Butterfly Ball, and then on 19th at the Clark Center and Las Osas Community Center, Fremont Theater, and at the Museum for the Wild Child event.
And the Butterfly Ball is kind of the kickoff for the whole week. So
yes.
I hope a lot of people will come join us at the Butterfly Ball. I know there's going to be great music, dancing, a couple films, and wonderful food, and supporting a great nonprofit. And then if people want information about the different films that'll be showing in other parts of the Central Coast, how do they find out?
If you go to My805Tix, and then you can also go to Central Coast State Parks Association and go to our events page, and that will bring you to the Wild and Scenic Film Festival.
And then if people want to join CSPA to be a member, also through your website.
Absolutely.
Find information.
Mm-hmm.
And then what if someone listening says, "I am passionate about all sorts of different things, and I would like to teach them"? How did they participate or become a docent? You know, there's a lot of people that have moved here and are looking kind of that second career, that second passion. How do they get involved to do that?
Absolutely. And we need you, especially in the Monarch Grove. We need some more Monarch troops.
Okay.
some more advocates. So go to the website, California State Parks, and you'll see volunteer in our parks. You can also visit the Central Coast State Parks Association's website, and you'll see volunteer in parks tab there as well.
And then my last question is this: would you recommend to your daughters to get a degree in natural resource management today?
Oh, highly.
Okay.
Absolutely. It was the most amazing experience.
Yeah. How did that change you?
Oh my gosh. I can't even imagine, to be honest, where I would be if I hadn't gone that route. It's definitely given me a different perspective on my environment and my relationship to the environment.
Because I think we focus as parents very much on the tech and STEM and STEAM parts of our education system. And I wonder if we're not missing out and tapping into young people like you found yourself, who wasn't really focused on school, but when you were offered this opportunity to be outdoors and do this work, it awakened a whole new part of you.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I have hope. The national or next generation science standards, their big focus is on experiential learning. So I'm really hoping that we kind of focus our attention on experiential learning and get our kids some hands-on experiences in nature.
Absolutely.
And getting those teachers out to field trips.
Yes, which is what you're helping to sponsor, is
exactly.
Getting kids out into nature. Thank you so much, Kristen Hallin, for being my guest today. Central Coast State Parks Association, Butterfly Ball, September 14th. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I will be sending home a few shows from the road in the next couple weeks, so I look forward to sharing those conversations with you. You can find me through the email address, elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also join us on our Facebook page or on Instagram, elizabeth_TRT. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Come on back. Imagine that.